There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, our podcast that rounds up the very best bits of today's show from Wednesday, February the 12th.
Let's talk about local companies. Let's talk about NMC Health in particular. Still making headlines, the share very active in London yesterday, rising and then falling. We've been talking to Ali Taki, who's head of equities at Ras Mala Investment Bank here in Dubai, about NMC Health. The 30-second recap is it's the company founded by B.R. Shetty, the Abu Dhabi billionaire, his hospital company, really successful, floated on the London Stock Exchange, but the share's down 70% since December after the American investor known as Muddy Waters raised questions about NMC's financial health. We've had Ali in to talk about this and get his take on this. And actually, he says, despite all the challenges with the balance sheet and in the boardroom, the core business of NMC Health, of running hospitals, mainly in Abu Dhabi, throughout the UAE, is going pretty well. And he thinks it's a solid business. This is Ali Taki.
Basically, we would like to look at NMC in multiple sleeves. So the one sleeve that we like to look at is operationally and how the company is doing. And I think the strategy of the company, the sector it's in which it's operating, its footprint in the region, that is all very attractive, very interesting, still has a lot of potential for it. And that kind of explains the interest that we've seen from a lot of international players or some of the regional investors in perhaps acquiring a piece of NMC at this point in time.
So the fundamental business of NMC, of running clinics and hospitals, getting patients in and getting paid for doing it, you think that remains relatively solid?
At this point, it remains solid. The challenge is going forward because what's happening around the company is without a doubt distracting the management from executing their plans, their strategies in the region. But typically, these are the times where investors that have interest watch closely. We generally look at such situations very closely with a great interest. And in my opinion, this particular incident or this one in particular looks extremely interesting. Ras Mala is currently weighing the options for potentially a bid.
Ras Mala is weighing the options for a bid at the moment. As a takeover or just to buy a stake in the organization?
Unfortunately, won't be able to disclose much details at the moment. But it is something that we do regularly. We keep an eye on such situations. And the fact, what I started with, that the footprint, the strategy, working the clinics, the specialty care that they're involved in are extremely attractive in an underserved region from a healthcare perspective, which is the MENA region.
Right then.
Interesting.
Busy day ahead then. What do you do with your day? I don't know. Might go out for lunch, read the news on TV. Me? I'm buying a multi-billion dollar healthcare company.
With Tom's $1 million in the suitcase that you gave him a little earlier.
That was Ali Taki, head of equities at Ras Mala. The other thing we were talking to him about, Tom, was some of the local companies that have reported earnings. Damac, reporting a loss for the first time in about a decade. Doing pretty well. The telephone company earnings flat at about 1.7 billion dirhams. You've been looking at those Damac numbers, haven't you?
I'd love to say I was looking at the numbers and making sense of them, but I think there are people much better qualified to do that. I was just looking at the headline more than anything. And the fact that they came out yesterday and reported their loss, first annual loss in a decade. I thought that was quite a sort of bold statement because those are the headlines. They could have been sugarcoated a little bit. It could have been we could have expected more of the figures have leveled out, or we're seeing more of a sort of stabilization, etc. But the fact that they've gone with reported first annual loss in over a decade, sales and revenue fell significantly, begs a couple of questions. Kudos to Damac to a certain degree for agreeing to do that. But B, why has it got to that point? And why now, on what has been a sort of steady curve of declines when it comes to real estate? Are we getting to that point now where there is just too much inventory in the market out there. Just interesting, and I wonder whether that is going to be the first of other significant developers to come out with honest figures, honest reports at the end of last year, beginning of this year. But I was just talking to you and getting you sort of get a guidance on this one. They were implored that they had to do this as a publicly listed.
Exactly. DMACC is a listed company, has been for some time now. So you've got to report your quarterly results. Now, we are in February now, so they're reporting the fourth quarter of last year, which brings us up to the full year. The rules in Dubai are this. You have got, from the end of the period that you're reporting in, 45 days to produce your results. So if it's 31st of December is the cutoff point, you've got 45 days. Mm. Do the math. That brings you to about Valentine's Day, the middle of February. It's the, what, 12th today?
Yep.
So they've left it about as long as they can. 14th is, but everyone has to have reported by then. And you say that they've come out and been honest. Well, they have, because their financials are audited. So they were very little choice on this.
Yeah.
The headline on the press release that they put out yesterday was not DMACC reports its first loss in a decade. That's what the media reported.
That's what we picked up on, yeah.
The headline on the DMACC release is DMACC Properties announces 2019 preliminary financials. And it says the highlights for the year ended 2019 were revenues at 4.4 billion dirhams, booked sales at 3.1 billion dirhams, deliveries of 4,700 units, and so on. They don't mention the loss until a little bit later on. I mean, that's fine. I'm not suggesting for a moment that they're not being transparent.
Yeah.
But no, they're not holding a press conference, you know, and banging the drum about this.
It does make for interesting reading as not just an investor, but also as a resident here in the UAE. So again, if you are a resident of, an inhabitant of a DMACC property, I'd love to get your thoughts. How are the new developments faring in the competitive market out there? We know that a few of the Accoya projects or deliveries are now coming online for the master development down there. You'd assume that DMACC Hills and the Trump Estates have filled up now, or certainly more significantly than this time last year. A lot more of those units have been delivered. So what sort of impact have they had? Obviously, the bottom line from them was, we look forward to 2020, mention of Expo 2020 as well in terms of short and long-term impacts, boosting all sections of the economy, as I'm sure we are all hoping at present. Whether that results in developments, we'll wait and see.
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that Hussein Sajwani did mention, the chairman of DMACC, and he praised what's happening in Dubai in terms of property market reforms. He says, and this is a direct quote, thanks to the reform-oriented leadership of this country, the market is poised for a long-term upswing. Mm. From announcing long-term visas to boost demand to establishing the Higher Committee for Real Estate to create a balance between supply and demand, government initiatives remain the key driver for the sector's growth. And he particularly singles out His Highness Sheikh Mohammed, Prime Minister of the UAE, Vice President and Ruler of Dubai. But you remember, back in September, Hussein Sajwani gave that quite explosive interview to Bloomberg Television, yeah, when he said, we have to stop building for about 18 months. That's what we've got to do. And there was a bit of a kind of tit-for-tat spat between him and Mohammed Alabar, yeah, in the media, talking about some of these issues. So, but now he's in this statement saying, well done to the leadership. They've come out. This higher committee that they set up, again, late last year, in Dubai, to look at all the government-related entities, so the Nakheels, the Miras, the Dubai Holding, MR Properties, government has a large, significant shareholding in that, even though it's a private organisation, to look at supply is something that Hussein Sajwani had wanted for a while, and it seems to, in some senses, have happened.
I think that's, you make a very valid point there, and I think it is, the market is better for those discussions. You know, if you have quite a public spat between two of the leading businessmen and two of the leading developers here who are in disagreement, I think there's nothing wrong with that, because it allows you to enables you to come up with a better picture. Equally, when you hear certain members of the Habtour family talking about oversupply and over demand as well, I think that is good for the economy overall here in general. And therefore, I don't think these figures should be sort of snuffed at in terms of, oh, you know, this is negativity and us jump on the back of it. Yes, I understand that. But it just shows a reality in the market.
And also, I mean, potentially, we were talking to Ali Taki about which stocks should we be buying now if we gave him Tom Urquhart's fictional million dirhams. You know, you could argue that the DMACC, you know, for the bold investor, DMACC share price is down significantly over the past 2 or 3 years. I'm looking at the numbers now and So where were we? Back in early 2018, you had 2017, 2018, 3.5 dirhams for a Damac share. Now you can get one for 64 fils.
Yeah.
So yes, the real estate market has softened since then, but this stock is trading at a significant discount. And if you believe long-term in the market, then, you know, there's a case to be made there. Not saying you should. It's not a Business Breakfast buy recommendation, but it's interesting.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's talk health tech if we can. Ocadoc is the leading instant doctor appointment booking platform. It's just closed its $10 million Series A round following a $2.3 million seed round back in 2018. The latest fundraising round is officially the largest health tech Series A anywhere in the MENA region. The announcement was made yesterday at the STEP conference, the leading tech festival for emerging markets. To tell us more about that achievement, we're joined by the founder and the CEO of Ocadoc, Fadıl Bentürker. Good to see you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
First and foremost, congratulations on breaking records.
Thank you.
Record seeding, record funding. How did you do it, first and foremost?
Basically, we've been very fortunate, and we met a lot of investors very interested in what we've been doing, in the problem we've been solving, and I think the investors have joined us more as team members and really being very excited to be part of this story in solving a real problem in the region and beyond.
In terms of the money itself, how key is that for you and your team to achieve goals and ambitions for the next stage for Ocadoc?
Yeah, I mean, funding is extremely important. For us, obviously, it's not only about the amounts, it's about what we will do with this money. Cash burn is definitely a very hot topic for a startup. As a company, we don't want to be a company that want to raise a lot of money across 5 or 6 rounds. We are looking at profitability. We are looking at managing that money to have a concept and a business model that makes sense for investors and that can be highly sustainable, basically.
How do you do it, Fadıl? I mean, this is not an easy market to raise money in at the moment. We saw a record number of startups in the Middle East, North Africa receiving venture funding last year. Number of deals increasing by 31%, according to Magnet, a startup data platform. So there is competition out there in all forms when it comes to startups, when it comes to applications, when it comes to health tech as well. How do you do it? How do you set yourself apart? What sets Ocadoc apart?
So the main difference with Ocadoc, and we can proudly say it, that we are the only one health tech startup in the booking field that does real-time instant appointments. So how we do it is we connect directly to the hospital information systems, right? And that makes us very, very unique compared to anyone, right? And that is with the aim to give a great patient experience, a great healthcare provider experience, right? That's one of our leadership principles. And this is really the main thing that makes us completely different, right? So when you book an appointment on Ocadoc, it's done on the facility, on the hospital level. It just pops up on the calendar. So that's real-time integration that we do. Takes time, but gives us such a great experience. And we get a very high number of repeat users. Patients are happy. Healthcare providers don't need to call back patient because they have received just a lead or a booking request. And this is really what made us different. So,
One thing I want to ask you about is reputation. Ocadoc obviously launching recently, and reputation is built from Ocadoc, but your reputation precedes you as well. You've held some very high-profile roles in the UAE, in investment banking, then of course Suit.com, Noon.com most recently as well. You're a name that goes hand in hand with startups and success. Has that helped as well with the development of Ocadoc in the past, the reputation that precedes you?
It helped, but it played also a role against me, and I'll tell you a bit of stories. So it's definitely the experience we got from e-commerce. Myself and the team has allowed us to build very strong technologies, scalable technologies. We've seen that scalability, you need to think about it at a very early stage. Otherwise, you have to redo your technology. So these are the great learnings we've got, and today our technology allows us to release extremely fast. We do weekly releases. It's very agile, right? But I'll give you some other examples. When you come from an e-commerce background, sometimes you just want to replicate what you know, right? And that could be a mistake that we have done, actually, by thinking that we should just replicate certain things, especially when it comes to marketing. And we realize that, no, this is a different industry. We have to unlearn certain things and learn again and be really close to our customers and really learn from them rather than trying to implement other industry knowledge, basically. So, yeah, a bit of both.
What tips would you pass on to people who are looking to raise money? And I ask that question partly because next week we've got an event happening, an event on raising money. We're doing it in partnership with our friends at Etisalat. How to raise money. What's the one thing that you've learned about raising cash?
For me, the advice I would give is really about honesty, right? Honesty with investors. It's a responsibility to raise money, right? You are basically seeking funds from investors. Investors that on the early stage are investing in the team mostly, right? So the concept is fairly new, especially in health tech, what we are doing. It's very, very few companies in the world have done it, right? And they are quite successful, but you are not in an industry that is extremely mature, right? Like e-commerce, you have millions of e-commerce players around the world, right? So it is a responsibility. And I think it's important for the region that when you raise money, you build that trust and you're basically showing really all the strength that the team has and be very transparent on the weaknesses, right? And I think...
Be transparent about the weaknesses.
Absolutely. When you are basically...
What's your weakness?
We had basically, as we built up, we've discovered that we have taken sometimes wrong directions, right? And we're testing the business model, right? So rather than really trying to say, okay, this was the initial business plan, and you know what, it's going to come, it's just a matter of time. It's very important to be honest and say, okay, this is what we've tried. Numbers are not showing that we're on the right track. We need to rethink about it, right? So being that honest and really adapting, being really agile also with your investor is extremely important. And investors are really smart. They understand, they support you. And I think that's what builds even more traction with other investors, right?
We've certainly helped to build success so far. Fadil, really appreciate your time. Congratulations again.
Thank you very
on
much.
The funding. Best of luck moving forward. And we'll definitely be catching up with you again very soon. Our thanks go to the founder and CEO of Okadok, Mr. Fadil Bentürker. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Natasha Thomas with us in the studio. Morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Richard.
Top story, of course, on the ARN News Centre app is the UAE response to the coronavirus. What can you tell us?
Yes, so we've been hearing from Abdulrahman bin Mohammed bin Nasser Al Owais, who is the UAE Minister of Health and Prevention. He has been talking about the steps being taken by the UAE to contain the disease. He made the statement at a Federal National Council meeting. Now, apparently, each case of coronavirus or COVID-19, that's the new name from the World Health Organization, when it's detected in the UAE, that's followed by an average of more than 154 medical tests and screenings. Now, he said the screenings cover those who have come in contact with anyone diagnosed with the illness. He also confirmed that all the cases detected in the country are in stable condition. There have been 8 announced so far, out of which 1 fully recovered earlier this week. He also told FNC members that more than 500 staff members have been working around the clock to make sure the situation is under control. Now, in related developments, Li Shuhang, who's China's consul general in Dubai, he's been speaking about this. And he said that Chinese expats in the UAE who returned from their home country have been asked to self-quarantine in the wake of the outbreak. He said 14 days is the recommended isolation time, as symptoms usually, you know, aren't present during that time and they show up afterwards. So he's confirmed that all Chinese citizens who returned in January from the Hubei province, which is the epicenter of the outbreak, are being closely monitored.
Thanks very much indeed for that. Of course, updates on the ARN News Centre app throughout the day and on this radio station. Now, this is, for my money, the most important or at least interesting story of the past 24 hours. Public schools in the UAE have banned what, Natasha?
Homework. So you both have children and I'm interested to know your thoughts, but let me tell you what it is. So students in hundreds of public schools in the UAE will no longer be assigned any homework from the 16th of February. Now, this announcement has been made by the Ministry of Education. They've launched a new initiative to ensure that students make the best of their time in the classroom. So what they've done is they've merged two lessons, so there'll be no break there, into 90-minute sessions in Arabic, English, maths, science, design, and technology. Classes will be divided into 5-minute sessions of mental stimulation, 50 minutes of actual lessons, and the remaining time will be dedicated to activities. And they've also announced that school timings will not change under the plan, and this will be implemented across 256 government-run schools in Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
Tom, you're the authority on this because you've got three children. We only have two. Thoughts?
I sort of get it because of the fact that children don't get a huge amount of time to themselves of an evening these days. But at the same time, you've got to ensure that I went to boarding school and we were always, you know, given time to do our homework of an evening. Even if you were a day pupil at the school, you had to do your homework with the boarders before you went home, if you like. And you've got to sort of factor that in. You can't just sort of now sort of leave it to the fact that, oh, you know, the poor things, they're doing so much outside of school, etc. I don't know. I quite like the element of homework of an evening for a little bit of routine for our kids. But I think that they spend far too much time doing it. Now, whether that's just because they're not good enough to... I mean, that sounds awful, but in terms of they spend too much time doing their homework, whether they focus on it enough remains to be seen. But I just think... I think a little bit is helpful to keep a child's attention.
Okay. I mean, your children are older, so you obviously have more experience in terms... You know, the older children I've heard get a lot more homework. I mean, my son, the older one, is six, and he barely gets homework, and I, you know, it works for us. We are happy to help him out or just sit with him for about half an hour once a week. But I've heard that it gets more.
Just the half an hour once a week?
Yes.
That's it, yeah?
No, that's it. He's too young, right? So I don't know about you, Richard. Do you get a lot of homework? No, you shouldn't.
Yeah, and it's really ramping up. My 9-year-old is getting a lot. And my 6-year-old, or he's 7, yeah, yesterday, I can help him with his maths homework. 9-year-old is way beyond me. Yeah. Daddy, I'm stuck. Well, you're going to remain stuck until you can see a teacher on Sunday morning. So there's nothing I can really do there. I'm going to weigh in on this debate and I'm going to come down in favour of homework.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. Because I do a bit of corporate training and a lot of people do in Dubai. And there are various models of learning. One is called the AGES model of learning, and the S is about spacing. And the key thing to retaining information is you have to space it. It's no point learning something once in the classroom. You'll forget about it. But if you learn it once and then repeat it and then repeat it in quick succession, then it will stay. So the homework is a really important part of the S. Now, do they have too much of it? Potentially. Mm. But I think spacing is very important, and homework is when the spacing happens. So sorry, kids, but Dad's in favour of homework. Unless, of course, I have to help you with it, in which case it's a complete pain on a Saturday morning. What was your attitude to homework when your kids got to the age of 3 and a half and exceeded you in intellectual capacity?
I have to be really careful here because I will get it in the neck a little later on. If I take the moral higher ground here and say, well, you know, it was hours we spent of an evening. And, you know, it's a bone of contention in the Urquhart household that Tom, because of the nature of his work, was never around for bath time or homework. I do help out when I can. I'm exactly the same as you when it comes to... I had something on fractions I had to do the other day. Impossible. Thank goodness for Google. What was my one yesterday? I had to do a diagram. I mean, obviously, I wasn't doing it, miss, if anyone's listening, but I had to help out with a diagram of how seasons are impacted by the sun and the planets.
Give me a break.
Cameron did have 10 days ago at school, my 9-year-old, an architecture competition. It was amazing. He's going, my wife's an architect.
Full, bring that.
Full 3D model.
But taking a full scale design. Yeah.
3D printed prototype.
3D printed all over the shop.
We're nailing that one.
A PowerPoint to explain it.
All of the above. My news, pick of the papers this morning, is the unnamed piano delivery guy who did this. Did you see this one, Natasha?
No, I haven't.
It's a guy in Germany, a team of guys who are piano delivery people. It's a job, apparently. It's a thing. It's a specialist thing. And they were picking up a piano from one of the world's leading pianists, and they dropped it.
Oh, no.
It's $200,000 worth of piano. Before it was dropped, it sounded like this. That's Angela Hewitt, who is one of the world's leading pianists. It's a Fazioli piano, and it's unique in the world. Was unique in the world. Not unique now, it's firewood, but it was unique. It was the precious Fazioli F278, the only Fazioli piano with four pedals. But it cannot be repaired. The official diagnosis from Mr. Fazioli, who lives in northeast Venice, is that it makes no sense financially or artistically to rebuild this piano from scratch. It is Caput.
Oh, no. I wonder how they dropped it.
We don't know yet. What Mr. Fazioli has said is the movers, of course, were mortified. In 35 years of doing their job, this had never happened before. He did say at least nobody was hurt, which is a good thing. But it's the subject of an insurance dispute. So both the movers and Miss Hewitt, the pianist, are refusing to give details of what actually happened, because that is the subject of some consternation. But $200,000 worth of piano. Boom. She says it's like losing my best friend.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
We're talking video. Well, it hasn't yet, but it might have by the end of this interview. Delighted to be joined in the studio by Jim Lodebeck, who's the general manager of VidCon. It's a global series of video conferences, as its name suggests, and it's coming to Abu Dhabi next month. Morning, Jim.
Morning. Good to be here. Thank you.
So, the big issues that are going to be discussed at VidCon in Abu Dhabi at the back end of March, you say the big thing is this clash of short form and long form video and how everything's being shaken up. Tell us more.
Well, it used to be in the old days of online video, which, by the way, was only about 5 years ago. YouTube and those services were all about short form. You'd watch things for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and then television would be an hour, a half hour, 2 hours.
But three and a half in the case of The Irishman.
Exactly. However long you want to go. If you're binging, it could be all night. But now we're seeing more longer form showing up on the social video platforms, and we're seeing more short form show up in what you would consider traditional video. A lot more money and investment going into shorter form and longer form. So it's a continuum, not two ends of a pole with nothing in between.
So what can people here in the UAE learn from this? Let's focus not so much on making content for entertainment, for Netflix and Starzplay. That's interesting, but it's a different conversation. But in terms of content for social media, for companies or individuals looking to promote themselves, what's working?
So what works is not trying to treat it like traditional video, not going in and spraying your message around with a bunch of 30-second ads and then going on and moving on to the next thing. To really do it well, you have to understand the relationship between the creator and the audience are very different. It's a community. It's as if, I was told once by one of the folks that looked at one of the programs I used to work on, it's not a fan base, it's a friend base. And that connection that the creators and the audience have is a connection of trust, a connection of friends. And when a brand goes in to take advantage of that, you can't just jump in, put your message in, and leave. You have to partner with that creator to craft something that works for the audience, that works for what the creator has built, and do it on a long-term basis, over months, over years, and be part of it. Don't just come in and leave and expect that you're going to have success.
Who's doing it well at the moment? What examples can you give us?
So a great example is Nerf. So Nerf went out for these guys.
Nerf is the guns.
And balls and all that stuff. So there's this great group of folks that are in the sports. They're in Texas, and they were doing trick shots and all this other stuff. And NERF went to them 5 years ago and said, you guys are really, really interesting. We're, a lot of our kids that would usually buy our guns are not doing it anymore. We want to partner with you so that you can do these trick shots and so that you can, you know, but do it with Nerf guns. So rather than just a basketball off the top of a building into a basketball hoop, how about a Nerf gun or how about a Nerf football? And this partnership has been going on for 6 years. Both of them have grown up, and it's been immensely successful.
Anything that gets children handling firearms more often has to be a good thing.
As long as the firearms are soft.
That's a good... So, in terms of social media, you mentioned to me earlier that the really interesting thing is TikTok. Why?
Well, because it encapsulates a bunch of different things in media. First of all, it's really focused on 10-year-olds to 17-year-olds. It also uses AI, artificial intelligence technology, to feed you a steady stream of new things. Now, this is very short form, about under a minute long. You watch a video, you're like, I like that, swipe up. Another video similar to that, I like that, swipe up. An hour goes by and you're like, I just spent an hour and I thought it was 5 minutes. So they're using technology to inject videos that you might like into your brain, but they're also doing it for this 10 to 15-year-old, 17-year-old audience. And it seems like every micro generation gets their own platform. If you're 20, you're looking at that going, TikTok, that's so much for kids. Like, I'm the Snapchat generation. Add another 5 years and you're the YouTube generation. So it's almost like there's so much change happening that we're not talking 10 or 20 year generations. We're talking 5 year generations when it comes to platforms.
So when we talk generations, Jim, and to that end, if the trend is videos and content getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and I see it with my own kids at the moment. My son will not sit through a game of football. He just wants to watch the highlights at the end. Where does it all end? And does that mean an end for longer forms of content when we look at it from a generational point of view?
I don't think so, because you do get things that are so engaging that you want to go into it and be part of it. But what I do see us happening is inventing new styles of media and new ways to consume it that will suck you into things on a longer term. So maybe it's not a football game, but maybe it's a virtual reality headset that you put on that takes you into that world and crafts that story. And think about gaming. Is your son a gamer?
He is.
How long does he play those games for?
If he had his way, all day.
All day and all night. So look at it that way. That's a narrative experience that uses visual media and storytelling to suck you in. It just does it in a very different way from the passive lean back, let me just watch that sporting event. Mm.
There is no finer television spectacle than a five-day cricket test match that ends in a draw. But that might be a tough sell to the younger generation. That's what's happening in the United States. You've got a long history in television and video. I mentioned earlier on that you've built and sold not one but two companies, one to the Discovery Channel and two to Viacom, two global media giants. What's different here in the Arab world? Because you do these VidCon conferences all over the world, and now you're bringing it to the UAE, to the Arab world.
Well, a couple things. First of all, the amount of video, online video consumed here in the Arab world is probably the highest anywhere in the world. Mm. And there is so much that is consumed via these social video channels. And I'm talking about the entire region, in part because there may not be all of the established other media outlets and other areas that are there. So we see this huge concentration of people consuming it, and then a huge youth population that's looking at these platforms. And again, we come in, when bringing VidCon to Abu Dhabi, like we're doing in the end of March, we're very much trying to be in Abu Dhabi, part of Abu Dhabi, part of UAE, part of the Middle East, and bringing in the creators from here and the things that they're interested in and the platforms that they like to use. And by the way, those are also very different. And Facebook, for example, is big for teens in some parts of the world, big some parts of the Middle East, and not in other parts. Snapchat is huge in this country and not in that country. So we're respecting not only the types of content that people are looking at and the platforms that they're looking at, but what they like. And so you'll see more of that at VidCon here in Abu Dhabi than you would see necessarily at one in Singapore or in Mexico or in the United States.
20 seconds. Tom Urquhart, my co-host here, is the housewife's favourite, reads the news on television several nights a week. What piece of a career advice would you give to Tom or anybody else who wants to be creating video content?
Just do it. So start your TikTok channel, start your YouTube channel, start posting. And what I say for everybody who doesn't understand TikTok, which is probably everybody over the age of 15, put TikTok on your phone, make a video and post it every day for a month. Take my month-long challenge make video and post. No one's going to watch it. Nobody cares. But at least you'll understand how it works and you might find some stuff that you actually like on it.
Uncle Dad just got a bit cooler. T-I-K-T-O-K, isn't it?
Okay, yes, sir.
Searching it now, Jim.
Great talking to you. Appreciate your time. Jim Ludebeck, General Manager of VidCon, coming to Abu Dhabi next month. Appreciate your time.
Thanks.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.